All right, Daniel chapter 7. The first six chapters told an awful lot about the experiences of Daniel and his three friends and how God can take the greatest individuals in the world, as the world would look at them, and humble them. And he certainly did that with Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4. most likely that was for 7 years. I think I said 3.5 is a possibility, as one source said. I'm thinking more and more it is 7 years that he was in either dementia or some sort of state where he was not fully all there mentally. Now, as we get into the final six chapters of the book of Daniel, we get into more specific prophecies. And this is very interesting. Some of these prophecies were not given to Daniel during the life of Nebuchadnezzar. They're given during the time of Belshazzar. And Belshazzar was the son of Nabonidus. Nabonidus was the actual successor to Nebuchadnezzar. But we're not sure just why, but Nabonidus chose to leave Babylon and to fight wars in North Arabia against whoever it was. Well, one of them was the Edomites and others that he fought wars with, and he left Belshazzar in charge of Babylon. And so, as we mentioned, I think in chapter 6, or chapter 5 there at the end, Daniel was made the third in charge of Babylon, not the second, because the second was Belshazzar. And that was the reason why he was made second, when he told Belshazzar what the handwriting on the wall meant and everything. Now, during the reign of Belshazzar, he began to reign. Remember, it was 539 B.C. And during this time, Belshazzar, before this time, did not know Daniel. Because when you, I'm just going back reviewing, when in chapter 5, the mother queen had to introduce Belshazzar to Daniel. And that was at 539, because that very night, after giving him the interpretation of the handwriting on the wall, Darius leading the Medes under the gate when the river lowered, and they killed Belshazzar. That was it for him. How long had Belshazzar been ruling as co-regent with his father in Babylon? He came to power in either 556 or 553 B.C., which is the 6th century B.C. So by the time we come down to when his death and the Persians conquer the city through the Medes, you're looking at almost, well, let's see, from it would be 17, either 14 or 17 years, depending on which of the dates that you would take. All right, now with that in mind, let's look at chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, when's the first year of Belshazzar? It's either 556 or 553, depending on which historian you read and believe. They both can make a pretty good case. I tend to think it's the one 556, because that's the year that Nabonidus left Babylon after becoming the king of Babylon following the death of Nebuchadnezzar. So in the first year, but he's not known by Belshazzar here in this prophecy or this vision he's going to receive. Belshazzar's not Daniel. Daniel who? Not until what? If it's 556, that's what? 17 years later to 539. So anyhow, what's Daniel doing? What's his job and so forth? He certainly was in a high position under Nebuchadnezzar, but Belshazzar apparently didn't know him. So in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. And then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. This wasn't just a dream like you and I probably would have. This one was really quite different. Daniel spoke, saying that I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Now, to the Jewish people, the great sea is the Mediterranean. It's not the Persian Gulf. And so he's seeing this in a vision, like a dream and a vision that he's having, but it is very clear to him. It's not the things that we have that maybe that don't make any sense. He knew this was obviously much more than that. In verse 3, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. Before I go on, let me read verse 4. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings, and I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now, we know that's Babylon, of course. What's interesting about the seventh chapter, here in verse 4, 5, and 6, we have the first three. One is like a lion, the other one, as we're coming to, is like a bear, and the third one in verse 6, like a leopard. Where would you go to find those three descriptions of the beasts again? Revelation, right? Revelation 13, verse 1, 2, and 3 in there. And there it's the same description and the same animals describing that beast that John sees coming out of what? The sea. Coming out of the sea. So chapter 7 corresponds very close, almost the same thing to Revelation 13. Also, chapter 7 corresponds back to chapter 2, the original dream Nebuchadnezzar had that Daniel was able to interpret. And not with the same animals, because there it's a statue, it's a man. But each part of that man figures quite a bit. The head of gold was who? Nebuchadnezzar. Here he is the one that's like a lion, and so on. All right, let's go on here and look at some of the description given here to the rest of them. We know we're very familiar by the time we get to the seventh chapter with Babylon. What about the rest? And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear. Now, it was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. Now, I'd like to use some quote here from the Expositor's Bible commentary, which is a good conservative one. It's a commentary written not by one person, but by, I think, about 78 different authors, if I remember right, who contributed to this commentary. And it's been, I think, quite good. And on this point here of the history, I wanted to just share a little bit with you on the second one that we're talking about here, the one like the bear, turns out to be the Medes and the Persians combined. Now, you know, one thing's interesting, the Medes and the Persians were enemies at one time until Cyrus the Great. Of course, that's the term he gave to himself. Cyrus the Great came to power. Cyrus was, of course, prophesied in the book of Isaiah, chapters 44, and leading into chapter 45, that he would conquer Babylon. And he was named by name in that prophecy over 120 years before he was born. And that was the prophecy shown to Cyrus later, after he had conquered Babylon. When you go to the first chapter of Ezra, this was shown to Cyrus. Cyrus gave the decree to go back because he believed when was pointed out to him that you, Cyrus, you were prophesied by our prophet from our God and religion 120 years ago. And so he obviously quite impressed by that. Not that he became a believer, but that they believed, of course, in multiple gods. And, well, that's amazing that your God knew of me before I was born. Let me just notice there, look at verse 5 once again. The second bear, the second was like a bear, was he raised up on one side. Keep that in mind, one side. And he had three ribs in his mouth. He was eating three ribs from what? Well, from what he devoured. What did he devour? Let me just read a little bit here. One side of the bear was higher than the other, and Daniel saw it devouring three ribs from some other animal it had killed. Indeed, it was divinely encouraged to feast on the ribs. This corresponds perfectly to the three major conquests the Medes and the Persians made under the leadership of King Cyrus and his son Cambyses. Now, the Lydian kingdom in Asia Minor, which today is, of course, Turkey, it fell to Cyrus in 546. The Chaldean Empire, which he annexed in 539, and the kingdom of Egypt, which Cambyses, his son, acquired in 525. And we have always taught this as well, and the commentaries certainly uphold that, that those three ribs that the bear was on his one side devouring because he devoured those three kingdoms. Now, what's interesting, too, is that Nabonidus, the successor to Nebuchadnezzar, had made a pact with those three because he feared the Persians when the Persians made a pact with the Medes. Up until that time, the Medes were enemies to the Persians. But Cyrus had come to power in the mid-50s of that century, just as Belshazzar and Nabonidus had. Now, Nabonidus was okay with Cyrus until he saw that he made the pact with the Medes. And then he began to get nervous. And he was out west, and Babylon was east. So he began to send his envoys to Lydia in Asia Minor, to Egypt down south, and, of course, Babylon, he already had control, and his son was co-regent ruling over it. And so those three in a triangle, he was hoping, would protect him from the rise of the Medes and the Persians under Cyrus. And that may have also been, once Cyrus got wind of that pact, may have been one of the reasons why he went after Babylon and all three, and Lydia as well. But Cyrus, when he had expanded his empire, he went clear up into what to southern Russia today. And it was quite a conquest that he was making. And eventually, finally, it was under his son Cambyses that Egypt was also taken and came under the Persian rulership. All right, so the second beast here is the Medo-Persian Empire. And let's move on here down to verse in which we're going to... It's going to be more specific about the Medo-Persians and the Greeks in chapter 8. Now, verse 6, after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. And the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. And here's the first time that we see of the Greco Empire. Of course, the four would be the division after Alexander the Great would die at an early age of about 33 years of age. And we'll see more of this in the eighth chapter as it's described. The prophecies now are kind of progressive, one after the other, and you get more information. If you just start reading chapter 8 by itself, you really need to read chapter 7, then chapter 8. Why? Because if you look at the end of chapter 8, it talks about a person rising out of those four kingdoms after Alexander's death, and that one of them, a king, shall rise, verse 23, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. Now some have concluded, well, the final individual who will set up the final abomination of desolation is a Greek. Because in chapter 8 it's talking, these are out of this kingdom, these are all Greeks. Ah, but go back to chapter 7. What do you see? Chapter 6 here is talking about the Greco Empire, which is like a leopard. It has four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads. That's right. It was divided into four different kingdoms after Alexander died. Then what happened? Verse 7 and 8, after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. So how do we reconcile the end of chapter 8 with the fact that there is a kingdom to come after the Greco kingdom, the division of the Greco kingdom? Well, we'll hang on, we'll get to that. So there is another to come, which of course you know is the Roman Empire. Dreadful, terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was just like you find in chapter 2. Remember that? Was devouring, breaking in pieces, trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts and were before it, and it had 10 horns. This is unusual and different. Now in chapter 2, the vision that was interpreted there by, or the dream interpreted by Daniel, what had the bottom part representing the Roman Empire had two legs and what else? Ten toes. Now we see it's called ten horns. This is an unusual one because it's going to, of course, resurrect itself 10 different times. And we'll see that again because it's repeated in the book of Revelation. Verse 8, I was considering the horns. And there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, with a mouth speaking pompous words. Now, what kind of pompous words is he speaking here? It says great things in verse 8 in the center margin, but it's more than that. That doesn't really tell you what it actually is. In the book of Revelation, the 13th chapter, where it talks about that second beast, which is this little horn, what is he speaking? Blasphemous words. That's what he's speaking. That's what these pompous words are. They're blasphemous. And that's what the book of Revelation revealed, because he is claiming, frankly, an office that is God's or is Jesus Christ's office. So we see, yes, indeed, this fourth kingdom, which will follow the Greco kingdom, it did not come into power until about, well, I should back up and give you some dates. The Medo-Persian Empire came into existence, and I mean, as far as conquering Babylon and becoming the great kingdom that it was noted to be, and it started in 558, and it ended in 330 BC when Alexander the Great defeated the Persians. Well, a couple of years after defeating the Persians, Alexander died, and then for 7 years there was a war on between his generals how to divide up all that he'd amassed. He had all from Europe to Asia, and it was divided up four ways. And, of course, we'll get into those four ways as we get closer to chapter 11. Now, the Roman Empire actually began around 31 B.C., went all the way to 476 A.D. in time. And so it had just come into its power and ruling all of Europe and Asia. The Roman Empire went all the way at the time of Christ to the Euphrates River. They were not able to really cross, and they did later, but at that time, the Euphrates. Why? Because of the Parthians. And the Parthians, as Josephus tells us, were part of the lost tribes of Israel. And had grown. Now remember, 700 years has gone by since they were taken into captivity. And here we as a nation are, what, 200 and... I have to stop and think, what are we, 225, 250, whatever it is, years old, and look how large population-wise we are. Well, those people were not under captivity for 700 years, only actually for a relatively short time. Now, they would have been conquered, and parts of them would have been conquered by either, most likely the Persians for a while, but by the time that you get, they have amassed a pretty strong kingdom. And they can defend themselves pretty well, and they held the Romans off at the Euphrates River up until 221 A.D. when they were defeated in battle at that time. Was that all of the lost ten tribe? No, that was only a part of them that was there that had multiplied, had moved south into what today is Iraq. They're not there now, though. Coming back here, let's go to verse 9. I watched till thrones were put in place. And the Ancient of Days was seated. Now here's where we're going to get into seeing that there's two in the God family or the Godhead. The Ancient of Days, as you'll see in verse 13, is the Father. And his garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. Now I don't know how to explain what these wheels are, but you find this is also mentioned over in the book of Ezekiel in chapter 1 and in verse 15, if you want to read there about these wheels. It's not the easiest thing to understand, but it's almost like he moves on these wheels, whatever they are. Some people have speculated, well, see, flying saucers right there. I'm not kidding. That's a But anyhow, its wheels, a burning fire. Verse 10, a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him, which would be what? Angels. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated and the books were opened. Now, what books would that be? Well, certainly wouldn't... not only just the books, probably, well, the books hadn't even been completed. There was a long ways to go on that as far as the Bible. But how about the Book of Life? That might be a very important book to, and it's talked about, by the way, all the way back to, Exodus chapter 32, where he first mentions the Book of Life to Moses. Verse 11, I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words, blasphemous words, to be more direct, which the horn was speaking. And I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. And as for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Yes, they were. They lasted for, in most cases, a couple hundred years. but these different resurrections of the what would be the Roman Empire did not last as long as the ones previous to them. You know what's interesting, too, when you think about it, God's people down through the ages, starting, we can go right to the time of Christ, the first century church, they had these things. And Paul obviously taught the same thing we are teaching today when it came to these prophecies. Why? Because, they could see it. It's there in history. There, later in the end of the first century, Josephus has it in his history called Antiquities of the Jews. So, yeah, they knew about Babylon and Persia and Greece and now Rome, and they were seeing Rome. And they knew that the fourth kingdom was obviously Rome, and that... yet it would have 10 kings. This is also something very important to the church in the last 2,000 years, because the church could see by reading this and understanding and having their eyes open because of what had gone before, possibly when Jesus Christ, when the time of the actual end would be, they could see all of these things, that God's hand was here involved in the affairs of man, and he had a plan being worked out here below. Many in Europe in the last 2,000 years could see. They saw this little horn. They were, in many cases, became martyrs to this little horn and to its pompous words, and they would not submit to it. They would not submit to it. They knew what it was. They knew what it was. Verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. Now, the Son of Man is very interesting, because Jesus Christ took this and used it, and he always said that he was the Son of Man. Nobody got upset over that, because sometimes it was used also for actual human beings, would be referred to as the Son of Man. Now, it was at the end of his ministry when he began to tell them he was the Son of God. That's when they began to want to pick up the stones. But he could tell them that he was the Son of Man. And this is what he was referring to, this Son of Man, of course, which was the one beside the Ancient of Days, who came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given, to the Son of Man was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. All right, that's obvious who we're talking about here. It's Jesus Christ, the Son of Man. That means then that the Ancient of Days is his Father. This is one of three different scriptures in the Old Testament showing that there are two in the God family. The other two, Psalm 110, and verse 1, now my mind goes blank. Come and sit on my right hand side. Help me out here. Some of you remember it. The one that is quoted the most in the New Testament by the New Testament writers, Psalm 110, verse 1. What? Come you and sit on my right hand side, and I'll make your enemies your footstool, something like that, I believe it goes. The other one, besides Daniel 7 here, is in Psalm 45. And I think it's about verse 7 and 8. The Lord said to my Lord, God said to my God, there. In Psalm 110, verse 1, the Lord said to my Lord, come, you sit on my right hand side. you'll find Psalm 45, Psalm 110, and Daniel chapter 7 right here, verse 13 and 14, shows that there are two in the God family, and there is one God, but there's more than one member. And the problem that people have had over the years is that they insist then that has to be two gods. Well, no, that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says there's only one God. Multiple scriptures say that, but that there's more than one. Let us make man in our image. And what we have to do is not take the position that the Greeks did, that it's either or. No, it is not either or. It is both. It is both. And that's why you come up with this idea of the Trinity, because most of those theologians of the fourth century had spent time, more time, in fact, in the school of Plato in Athens, Greece, than they did in the Bible. It was only later they were trying to figure out how are we going to read this new philosophy into the Bible, because it wasn't there. All right, let's go along here to verse 15. And I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Those great beasts which are four kings which arise out of the earth. Four great kingdoms, really. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. I like that one. That's a pretty good verse right there, isn't it? verse 19. Well, then I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet. And about the ten horns that were on its head, about the other horn which came up, before which three fell, namely, that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous or blasphemous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. Well, it was that way, certainly against many in the Middle Ages. This little horn did dominate. And you go back and look at the persecutions, the Spanish Inquisition, not only in Spain, but even in other parts of Europe, northern France, Austria, Vienna area, where many people died because they did not agree with or go along with the Pope, to put it very plain, and would not submit to the Catholic Church. Now, did they directly do it? No, they went to the civil powers and had the civil powers arrest them and carry it out for them. They, of course, are responsible as far as God is concerned for that. And it was a power struggle, you might say, because they wanted absolute commitment and surrender to them as a church. Well, you know, you stop and think what conditions were like in the Middle Ages leading up to the Renaissance. We had people who were trying to translate the Bible and did, and then they were burned at the stake for doing it. Now, that is so inconceivable to us today, that you would arrest a person and you would tie him up to a stake and set lumber underneath here or whatever things on fire to burn him alive. Why? His crime was he translated the Bible into a different language than Latin. And yet that was, those things took place. Tyndale was the one who was burned at the stake, who translated the Bible. This was long before the King James translation came along. And others as well, for simply trying. What was the first thing when the printing press was developed? To print the Bible, so people could read the Bible. And why was that? Because the ones who were doing that knew that the state religion was lying. And even the priests knew nothing about the Bible. And they just followed whatever they were told from those above them. And, you know, it's just, it was mindless. Well, let's go on here in verse 22. Until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Thus, he said, the fourth, I like to believe that that time's very near. I hope it is. That is getting to be very close. Of course, we have a problem. We've got this tribulation between now and then. And we just have to put our faith and confidence in God to protect us, just as those brethren in the Philippines did when that gigantic storm came. And he did. Verse 23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth and trample it and break it in pieces. And yes, he would. The ten kings are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them, and he shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue three kings. yes, and I have it in a booklet, but it's bound in a book. The Book of Revelation Unveiled at Last. It was published back, I think, in 1960. I wish, if any of you have that booklet not bound, you have it? Because when you open to the middle, you have that nice chart. That chart of showing all of these things. Because I'd like to be able to make copies of that. You open it up and have it printed so you could all see it. Most of you have never seen that, or if you did, you've lost it or whatever. I can't tear the book open. I've got a bunch of booklets, and they were all hardbound when we were in the church in Portland many, many years ago. Never thinking that things would happen in the church, that I'm very happy that I have all of those booklets and articles and everything. But if I could find a copy, maybe I can see you about that. I'd like to have it printed. Now, I don't know how they did this, because it was back before computers and all of that, and maybe you have the answer, Adam, that's quite a chart when you look at it, showing the 10 resurrections of the Roman Empire, and before that, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and so forth, and then starting with Rome itself, the fall of Rome, 476, the three, Ostrogoths, who's the other one? You got it right there. You're bringing it up. Okay. The three minor ones that were overthrown even by the papal state and so forth as it was developing. You're laughing. What did I say? Vandals. Vandals, Heruli, and Ostrogoths. Okay. Actually, I probably have it written right here, but I'm looking down trying to read it. Then following that, in 554, was the first time that we see what was called later in the book of Revelation, a major resurrection of what would be known as the Holy Roman Empire. In 554, Justinian in Istanbul, well, at that time it was not Istanbul, it was Constantinople, and they brought together, joining the two churches and the empire from the what would later be the Eastern Orthodox Church. The Eastern Orthodox Church broke from the Church of Rome in 1054 and became and is to this very day the Eastern Orthodox Church, which you probably know very little about. It used to be the Roman Catholic Church. And but the schism came to a head in the 1054 AD and has never come back together since. Justinian was bringing the two legs of the empire, just as in the statue of chapter 2 of Daniel, the two legs together, east and west, and united them in 554. Well, of course, he died, and time went by, and guess what? 800 AD, we have a German, not a Frenchman. He was Frankish, but the Franks were Germans. As a German, by the way, so was Justinian. He was an Illyrian. He was not a Greek or a Turk. The Illyrians were, at that period of time, German tribes that were migrating north of over Macedonia, heading in toward Europe. And he was an Illyrian and of one of the Germanic tribes. So was Charlemagne in 800 AD on Christmas Day. And the Pope comes, puts the crown on his head, crowns him Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Well, Charlemagne came and Charlemagne went. And it was 162 years later. Otto the Great, 962 AD. Guess what? Same ceremony again. And he's crowned by the Pope and to be Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire and, of course, unite the church and state all of Europe. That's, of course, always been the grand design. Well, time goes by again. We come up then to 1520 AD. As you will see in that chart, Charles V, or Charles the Great of the Habsburg dynasty, and he is crowned. And guess what? Just 3 years before that, what happened? Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the Wittenberg church door. And many of the German people of the German states, or not really states, they weren't a united state, let's put it that way in any way, but small little states, let's call it, they followed after him as he protested what was being done in Rome and would not go along with it in the various German territories and areas. Charles V wanted to conquer and wanted to kill him bring him to trial and have him burned at the stake. But then the Muslim invasion came in through southeastern Europe, and all of his troops and attention had to be turned to stop the Muslim invasion that was imposing coming in on his empire. I've told you this before, and then what happens after 1520? Well, we go another couple hundred years. We come to 1805. Napoleon. Napoleon is not a Frenchman. He is the head general over the French army, but he is of the Germanic tribes because his family came out of Lombard, northern Italy. The Lombards were Germans. They had resettled in the island of Corsica. And from there, he became eventually a general in the French army at a very young age, too. I think he was just 30 years old or something like that. He took the crown out of the Pope's hand, and he put it on his own head. And, he was a short man, by the way, too. And, short people have to show that they're not shorties. And so... And after that, that was number five of the seven heads. Then we've looked at and tried to figure number six. Mr. Armstrong said he felt that it began when the Italian city-states were united into one Italy and by Garibaldi in 1870, which led all the way up to Mussolini, who, by the way, declared himself to be emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. I think that was 1936. Joined with Adolf Hitler, and of course that's where the power of the Second World War was with the Germans. I personally believe that what you saw happen in the Second World War is really just a kind of a proceeding here of what's going to happen in the final one. Gives us a snapshot of, because you had, for example, Rommel running across North Africa, finally stopped by the British and the U.S. troops. But he was headed for the Suez Canal and the Glorious Land, just as you will see in Chapter 11, the King of the North will do. The terrible destruction and the terrible death that happened to the Jewish people, certainly there talks about that in prophecy as well, we will see. And it really was... just a prelude to, I think, what really is going to happen in a smaller scale, because Jesus said at the time of the end, it will be a time such as you have never seen before, nor shall ever be again. So that means that World War II is not the greatest. It's kind of basically setting the tone for the final one that will come. You know, it's interesting that here in another 2 years or less than 2 years, it will be 70 years since the end of World War II. Something to think about, 70, because that applies here. The Jewish captivity in Babylon was 70 years. And you find that number 70 a lot of times. Now we're coming up on 70 years since the sixth head was put down and destroyed. So I don't know. I'm not making any predictions. I'm just saying it's kind of interesting when you start look at some of the times that we're living in. And what will that mean? Well, we'll have to wait and see. Let me finish this chapter, and I will quit early here for you. Verse 24, the ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall be rise after them. And he shall be different from the first one, and shall subdue three. I've read that. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High. You know, when you claim to be the vicar of Christ, I mean, you're getting pretty high, aren't you? And some of the things that are, I mean, it's amazing. You would think that people could look and would question and the practices and things. Millions and millions of people have no idea what the Bible has to say in comparison to what the practices of that institution are. Because people are not to read the Bible in that institution. They are to follow whatever the institution tells them to do. Don't read the Bible, you listen to the priest. Everything comes out of Rome, does it not? Don't question whether any of these things are pagan, any of these things are, you know, praying to Mary, blasphemous, vicar of Christ, all saints, praying to saints, pray to this one, right, light all the candles and everything. It's just an amazing, nobody stops to question that. You would think all of the great news media people who pick politicians apart, they ignore it. It's not as though they don't know the history, the background, and the presence of that institution, but say nothing, absolutely nothing. But make sure that it is always appears in a very good light in the news. Okay, verse 25, he spoke pompous words against the Most High, shall prosper or persecute the saints of the Most High, I certainly did, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Now we see this in Revelation chapter 12, verse 17, when the beast will go after the remnant of the woman to make war during the and what's the time period there? Time, times, and half a time, 3.5 years, and it's referring to the actual time of the end here. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Yes, you'll see that if you read the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Well, that's a wonder. Verse 27 is a verse you want to mark because it's talking about us and to have part with Jesus Christ over his everlasting kingdom. And this is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my conscience changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. We'll stop there, but as you can see in chapter 8, verse 1, we're going to go to the third year of Belshazzar next time. And it is going to center on the second and third kingdom, that is the Persians and the Greeks. And bring the Greeks down to the end time, as you see at the end of the chapter. How is that done when the Romans follow the Greeks? Well, we'll see. All right. If you have any questions or whatever, send them to me, and I'll certainly be happy to try to answer them and bring them out in the next Bible study.